time.
Icon of Soul, March 30th. Get that.
And I love you. Yes, you once, twice.
Like Montreal, it sounds like CKUT. CKUT's annual funding drive is back, and this year we're celebrating the city that made us. From Friday, March 15th to Sunday, March 24th, tune in for an earful of Montreal-made magic. Your favorite programmers will be live in studio and live streaming online for the first time ever. Tune in online, on the good old-fashioned radio, or join us in person. CKUT friends and family will be providing the tunes for an opening party at Bar La Marche à Côté on March 14th and a closing night on March 23rd at Nouvel Etablissement. Stay tuned at our website for other events that put the fun in fundraising. Don't miss these celebrations of community radio and sounds of the city from your favorite local DJs. We need $50,000 to keep CKUT on the map. Powering a nonprofit radio station is more expensive than ever. Will you answer the call of your community before it's too late? Donate now by visiting ckut.ca/donate or by calling 514-907-9424. CKUT 90.3 FM, the sound of Montreal since 1987. Spring Into Action, Outrage, is happening March 11th through 24th. Spring Into Action is an annual event series that is organized and funded by QPIRG McGill and SSMU. Every spring, QPIRG organizes a week of free workshops, discussions, film screenings, and social events engaging local and global issues. We have an exciting lineup of events, including a screen printing workshop, community dinner and zine making night, Prison Abolition 101, and other practical and capacity-building workshops for organizing in the midst of injustice and anger. Check out the schedule of events at qpergmcgill.org or on our Instagram at qpergmcgill.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, March 13th. Thank you all for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, Asa Wynn-Stanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 159 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We have another packed show for you today, including interviews with writer Wala Sabah and activist Huda Amori, and a full roundup of videos from the Palestinian armed resistance with John Elmer. But first, some of the news that we've been covering at the Electronic Intifada. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said that as of Tuesday, more than 31,000 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 73,000 injured since October 7th, with many more thousands missing or buried under the rubble. At least 27 people, 23 of whom are children, have been recorded dying from starvation and dehydration as Israel, supported by the U.S., continues to prevent international aid convoys from entering the Gaza Strip. Israeli forces now routinely fire on crowds of Palestinians who meet the trickle of aid that is able to enter the northern Gaza Strip, with massacres of hungry people happening every day. The Gaza government media office said on Tuesday that, quote, the casualties of Israel's targeting of hungry people while waiting for aid has reached over 400 victims and over 1,300 injuries so far. Israel's practices, quote, confirm that the policy of starvation is currently a hallmark of Israel's plan, alongside its perpetration of acts of genocide and ethnic cleansing, the office stated. The health ministry said on Tuesday that, quote, the ground aid that arrives in the northern Gaza Strip is very, very small. It is not enough for anyone. This aid arrives through two routes. First, Salah Ad-Din Street, where there is a traffic island that was built by Kuwait, so it is called the Kuwait Roundabout. The other place is Al-Bahar Street at the Nablusi intersection. Hungry people gather in these two places hoping to get any food. Bombing gatherings of hungry people has become a daily routine, the ministry explained. Quote, it is practiced by the occupation and the international community sees it on screens. Hunger will destroy all the residents of the northern Gaza Strip. Aid is very little. The price of a meal may mean certain death. Help the residents of the north. Do not leave them prey to hunger, bombing, and disease. The doctors will die, the nurses there will die, and the world will witness the largest number of victims of hunger in the coming days. If you do not act today to save us, we will all die, the Palestinian Health Ministry stated. Instead of forcing Israel to abide by its legal obligations to not starve people and opening the various ground crossings to the thousands of aid trucks, the U.S. and other Western countries, supported by Jordan's Air Force, continue to drop meager amounts of aid by the air. On March 8th, one such airdrop killed at least five people, including a child, when the parachutes failed to open. Al Jazeera reported earlier today that airdropped parcels fell on solar panels at Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza City, destroying the panels which provide essential electricity to the hospital, which has, of course, already been bombed by Israel. A video of children rushing to gather what looks like pasta or grains that spilled from an airdropped parcel circulated on social media on Tuesday. Another video from yesterday shows children and elders sifting rice from the dirt after an airdrop in northern Gaza. The United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees reported today that at least one staff member was killed and another 22 were injured when Israeli forces hit a food distribution center in the eastern part of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. The agency's Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini said, quote, today's attack on one of the very few remaining UNRWA distribution centers in the Gaza Strip comes as food supplies are running out. Hunger is widespread. And in some areas, turning into famine. Every day, we share the coordinates of all our facilities across the Gaza Strip with parties to the conflict. The Israeli army received the coordinates, including of this facility, yesterday. Children are continuing to bear the brunt of Israel's starvation policy. A six-year-old child, Fadi Elzant, is currently hospitalized with effects of severe starvation and dehydration at Kamal Adwan Medical Center in the northern city of Beit Lahia. According to reports and interviews with his mother, Fadi has cystic fibrosis, which requires a specific diet as well as critical medications that are impossible to obtain in the Gaza Strip now due to Israel's ongoing blockade. Fadi's mother, Shaima, said in an interview that her two other children, who also had cystic fibrosis, died in recent years. Quote, I am afraid of losing Fadi, she said. And the charity Save the Children released a report this week saying that, quote, 5 months of violence, displacement, starvation, and disease on top of nearly 17 years of a blockade have caused relentless mental harm to children in Gaza. The report stresses that, quote, parents noted that children have given up on their hopes or ambitions for the future, and that, quote, in the context of the current unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, all the factors reported indicate that mental health consequences of this crisis will be more severe and more long-lasting than in other situations. Furthermore, these risks are known to be cumulative. The more risk factors children face, the greater the likelihood of poor and lasting mental outcomes, Save the Children added. The United Nations estimates that Israel's bombardments of residential units and other properties over the last 5 months have produced approximately 23 million metric tons of debris and rubble across Gaza. Agency partners report that it would take around 8 years to clear the debris, given existing capacities in the Strip, the UN adds. In her essential and wide-ranging analysis, the Electronic Intifada's senior editor Maureen Claire Murphy writes that, quote, the statistics from the last 5 months in Gaza as horrifying as they are, only provide a glimpse of the Holocaust that Palestinians there have endured. And without an immediate ceasefire, the worst may be yet to come. The following is a long excerpt from Maureen's piece. Israel's destruction and forced evacuation orders have displaced most of Gaza's population of 2.3 million Palestinians, many of them repeatedly. Some 1.5 million people now are concentrated in Rafah along Gaza's boundary with Egypt. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, said the military will invade Rafah regardless of any temporary pause. The U.S., meanwhile, has made clear that it will not impose any material consequences on Israel should it invade Rafah without a plan to protect civilians. Human rights groups and humanitarian agencies have made clear that such a plan is an impossibility, despite being well aware that such an operation would entail mass casualties and spell the end of already severely restricted humanitarian aid missions in Gaza. The forcible transfer of Palestinians ever southwards in Gaza has given rise to alarm that Israel intends a mass expulsion of the people from the territory to Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, where there has been recent land clearing and construction to potentially contain a population forced from the Strip. The Biden administration says it is opposed to this, with White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby saying that, quote, we don't want to see Gaza occupied, we don't want to see any of Gaza's territory reduced, and we don't want to see any forced displacement of the Palestinian people. But Israel is directly contradicting all three of those principles, with its intelligence ministry recommending the, quote, evacuation of the civilian population from Gaza to Sinai, a blatantly illegal policy being implemented on the ground by the military, which has destroyed wide swaths of civilian infrastructure for a buffer zone on Gaza territory, also a glaring violation of international law. And the Israeli War Cabinet's recently revealed post-Hamas plan calls for indefinite direct Israeli military control of the territory. Even calling Netanyahu's document a plan is a stretch, with Haaretz writer Alon Pinkas describing it as an unserious negation of the Biden plan, a list of statements that constitute open-ended Israeli control of Gaza with no political silver lining. The Netanyahu plan calls for civil governance in Gaza to be handled by local elements with management experience, who are independent from countries or entities that support terrorism, seemingly an attempted revival of the village leagues that were intended to counter the revolutionary influence of the Palestine Liberation Organization in the 1970s and 80s. It also includes an Israeli-controlled buffer zone in Rafah along the border with Egypt. Biden's plan, by contrast, envisions an international force in Gaza, an extension of governance by a revitalized Palestinian authority to the territory, which Netanyahu and members of his far-right government reject. What the Netanyahu and Biden plans have in common is a presumption that Israel will, in fact, remove Hamas as a governing entity in Gaza, hardly a foregone conclusion, as U.S. intelligence officials told members of Congress in February. Netanyahu and the Biden administration also share a total disinterest in how Palestinians wish to organize and govern themselves, more of the same denial of self-determination that is at the heart of the Palestinian national liberation struggle. That was a long excerpt from Biden's Regime Change Agenda Prolongs Gaza Genocide by Maureen Claire Murphy on electronicintifada.net. And finally, last night in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli military stormed the Jenin governmental hospital in the northern city of Jenin, killing two Palestinians and injuring five inside the emergency room. Palestinian resistance brigades in Jenin battled invading Israeli forces throughout the night. And in Jerusalem, the Israeli army killed a 12-year-old boy, Rami Hamdan al-Halhouli, in the Shufat refugee camp. The child was lighting a firework to celebrate Ramadan when Israeli forces shot him and then arrested him, according to reports. He was transferred to a nearby hospital and pronounced dead. Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir went to the police station to show his support for the cops who shot and killed the child, calling the child a terrorist who put the Israeli forces at risk.
שאני אומר לכל השוטרים, אני נותן לכם גב. חברים, אתם אומרים, ילד בן 12, ודאי עם זה. ילד בן 12 שהוא מחבל. ילד בן 12 שסיכן לוחם שלנו. ילד בן 12 שזורק זיקוקים, וזורקים בקבוקי תבערה, ברמות בקבוקי תבערה, בשועפת בקבוקי תבערה.
יש הבדל בין רמות על כביש ל...
That was Itamar Ben-Gvir. And also on Tuesday, a 23-year-old man, Zayd Khalifa, was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers near the Al-Jib military checkpoint in Jerusalem. And that's just some of the news from on the ground in Palestine over the last few days. Please go to electronicintifada.net to read some of our fantastic new features by writers in Gaza, now up on our homepage. And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Coming up, we'll have an interview with Palestine actionist Huda Amori, and we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments from the resistance in Gaza. But first, we're joined by Ali Abu Nima and Wala Sabah, a writer from Gaza who now lives in the UK. Wala is the Community Outreach and Partnership Officer at We Are Not Numbers, the collective of young writers in Gaza. Wala, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thank you so much, Noura.
Welcome, Thanks. Wala.
Yeah, welcome. Tell us about your family in Gaza, what you know of their whereabouts and safety right now.
So my family, as well as many of the Palestinian families, were displaced from the northern part of Gaza Strip to the south. Now they're staying in a tent in a displacement camp that was created for people who were displaced from the north. Situation is really dire at this moment. No access to food, electricity, water, or healthcare facilities. They're struggling daily, especially that Ramadan has come like a couple of days ago, and now they can't move around or this is the situation briefly. I have been talking to our writers in Gaza, our journalists in Gaza, and they have been experiencing lots of struggles and getting food aid. One of our writers and journalists there in Gaza, her name is Maram, and she told me that they have been waiting in a line for 6 hours to get only one cucumber with a couple of potatoes and some vegetables. She said they are depending on canned food, which is not healthy for them, eating for 6 months so far, and this is affecting their overall health. No electricity, as I said. They are taking showers in a sea directly because the Al-Mawasi refugee displacement camp in Khan Yunis is right next to the sea. So they are taking showers in a sea, which giving them some skin problems and inflammation. She said they have to go to Rafah to be able to get a treatment, and the medications is not available. My sister personally, she's a pharmacy student and in her second year, and because there is no one in the camp to provide any healthcare support for them, so she's taken lead and she has transferred my parents' living tent into a medical point for people to be able to get access to help. She's helping with the minimum she can. Because they have wounded people in the camp. They also have women who give birth. So she's taken lead of supporting those women, changing on their wounds, helping the children as well in their air problems and women in their inflammation. But again, they do not have any medications at this moment, and they have to go by themselves if available, like in Gaza.
Well, thank you for telling us about your family, and I'm so sorry to hear that what they're going through is exactly what we hear from almost everyone in Gaza. I want to ask you, Ramadan has just started in the past days. How is life different for people in Gaza during Ramadan? Are people trying to observe Ramadan, or is it simply impossible given the scarcity of food and the need to just be able to eat whenever they can? What do you know about that?
Okay, so you understand that moving around is not an easy task for them because they don't they prefer not to move it during the day. So now moving to Rafah and having access to medical facilities there and food aid agencies is not as easy as before. They only depend on one meal a day that is provided after the sunset. And that meal is provided by food agencies to them. But they are not, of course, it's not like any of the Ramadans we survived before. There is no joy, and there is no joy. They're not able to enjoy the family gatherings they used to have in the past. Again, they depend on canned food, nothing healthy. I feel that I feel like they should have like at least one healthy meal a day, which they cannot, as many of them have told me. They said again, there's nothing that hasn't changed. The same food they are eating, if available, it's only about canned food, no vegetables. They said they had to wait in a line to get 2 eggs from UNRWA a couple of days ago, and many of them were making fun that they paid for the transportation more than the eggs worth. But yeah, that's the food situation there.
Wala, what are people saying about these absurd and lethal airdrops that are, you know, being coordinated by Jordan, but used by Western countries, mostly the U.S. and some European countries, to circumvent, you know, not having to pressure Israel to open the crossings and let these thousands of aid trucks that are idling at these crossings in? What are people saying about what's happening with these airdrops?
I mean, it's not only my opinion, but it's quite ridiculous what's going on right now. Like dropping aid, why not just asking people to die, but asking Israel to kill people while they're full, not when they're empty stomach. So people want a ceasefire. This is what they are asking for. And then they can have the aid because the aid is stuck like in Egypt at this moment without access to Gaza. What people are asking for now is not food. They want a ceasefire, and then the food is important, but the ceasefire comes first. The U.S. is the same. The U.S. has dropped food aid as well, food parcel and people, but they were making fun of the what those food parcels contain. It doesn't even align with what Palestinians eat or what type of food it has, like very dried food as well, like pieces of salt and black pepper. They were making fun of the type of food. Just like, it's more of like show off that we are doing something while the U.S. can stop what's going on right now, but doesn't want to do so. Palestine, also Jordan, joined this food drop in. But again, people are not happy and not satisfied. It killed people. Like they're doing it even wrong. That is making people's life worse. People are not satisfied with this. I heard it from many of our journalists in Gaza, especially from We Are Not Numbers, that they were making videos of those food aid and saying that doesn't make any sense for them. And they wanted an immediate ceasefire before showing off that we're helping Gaza because they're not helping them.
And what about these plans that have been announced to set up a port to deliver aid, that the United States is going to build a port or a way for ships to land? And even the news that the first ship carrying aid has just left Cyprus. What are people saying about that? What's their perception of these plans?
Honestly, people don't have any trust in the U.S. People in Gaza don't have any trust in the U.S. at this moment. So they have suspicions of what's behind this port, what's behind this medical aid support that's coming from that port. Many people are just so suspicious, and they are staying alerted about something bad coming soon from this port. They're not encouraged. They're not enthusiastic about it. They said the U.S. could have stopped this war and then started the port, but they decided with the port without ending the war. So,
What are some of their fears or concerns about the port? Because I've heard some people outside Gaza say, oh, well, any way of getting aid in is a good thing. Why wouldn't people in Gaza feel that way?
Well, when people are outside of Gaza, they are not experiencing what people in Gaza they are experiencing, right? And it's just like being an outlooker at what's going on in Gaza. What makes sense for those people? Because people in Gaza know that they are experiencing the war themselves. And then if they're experiencing it, they know that the U.S. has been supporting killing the Palestinians from day one and supporting Israel's side over Palestinians. So why not? The first question, the main question is, well, why not ending the war first and then creating this port and supporting Palestinians? That's a logical question, honestly, from a person who's seeing the situation from the outside. Why not ending the war and then provide as many aid as you want? Why not in so many, so far, like over 30,000 Palestinians were killed, more than 12,000 children were killed. And what's next? What are we waiting for? Number of malnutrition, people dying from famine as well. What we're waiting for is it's not about food. It's about ending the war in Gaza. And more than this is America is the U.S. has been suspicious, like have lots of suspicions about its operations in Gaza and about having a military base in Israel that was recently discovered or even shown in the media. So Palestinians are having are fearing afraid that that Gaza will be under Israeli occupation now, under the Israeli presence for a long period. Now it's 6 months. At the very beginning, they thought it's going to be 1 week, 2 weeks, and then 1 month, and now we are 6 months, and it's extending. It's not stopping. So this port, if the aid will keep coming, this means that the war will extend for like probably a year or even more, who knows. So that's, Ali, the main concerns of the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Well, can you talk a little bit about your work with We Are Not Numbers and the community that you have helped build there, and what some of your contributors and colleagues are, how are they doing right now? What's happening with We Are Not Numbers?
First of all, We're Not Numbers is a youth-led Palestinian project. It's in Gaza. It was founded in 2015. The We're Not Numbers project focuses on training young people in Gaza Strip and as well as in many other regions in the world, Canada, Turkey, US, UK, in journalistic writing and how to defend Palestine, how to present the Palestinian case in the media. We wanted them to talk on their behalf, not to have people talking on their behalf. We have many people, like over 300 Palestinian writers and journalists in Gaza Strip at this moment. They're writing, and the Electronic Intifada has already partnered with some of them. They are all displaced. The majority, if not all, the people I know are displaced to the south of Gaza. We have a couple of our writers in the north. Unfortunately, many of our writers were killed, including Yusuf Dawaz, as well as Huda Susi, Mahmoud Al-Na'uq. They were all writers for We're Not Numbers. They were tragically killed by Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. So far, as I said before, as I mentioned, our writers are displaced. They are experiencing lots of struggles. Many of them are trying to get out of Gaza desperately to continue with their education. They haven't continued their education. They're still in their university bachelor's degree. They are so worried about their future. They are so worried about their family's future as well. They don't know if they will survive, and if they will survive from the bombing, if they will survive from the famine happening right now. So, but they are so optimistic about writing about Palestine. They want to tell what's going on. They feel that they are witnessing. There are eyewitnesses of what's going on at this moment. So they want to tell the world what's going on. And I feel proud that they are doing so.
We're very proud of them as well. And as you mentioned, we've had the privilege to work with many of the We Are Not Numbers writers, and we credit We Are Not Numbers for training and supporting and nurturing so many wonderful journalists and creative writers in Gaza. And that's been tremendously valuable to us in our mission of telling the stories of Gaza. And we are we offer our condolences for the We Are Not Numbers writers who have been killed. And we note that Israel is targeting intellectuals and writers. They're being killed just because they're Palestinians in Gaza, and everyone is being killed, but they're also targeting specific writers, journalists, intellectuals, university presidents, one of whom was our dear friend, Dr. Rifat Al-Arir. And he worked closely with We Are Not Numbers, I understand. Can you say a little bit more about his work and the legacy he left with We Are Not Numbers?
Dr. Rifat Al-Arir is a very incredible, amazing person in terms of academic life, in terms of passionate person about the stuff he's doing. He's one of the co-founders of We Are Not Numbers. He's been there since its establishment. He's been training our writers on journalistic writing and how to advocate for the policy, for Palestine and for the Palestinian rights. Many people are so grateful for him, for his contribution to Palestine. Since day one, he has been training our writers in Gaza. He's been providing sessions for We Are Not Numbers writers. He always encouraged them to write. He provided training on academic writing as well as feature writings and how to be careful about the terminology. He was so focused on this. Of course, our project is in English, so he also provided like proofreading for some texts. And he also helped connecting some of our writers to international magazines and online websites so they can talk and try it for them and to have their voice heard all over the world.
And that work continues, and that's very important. And we continue to honor Dr. Rifat by continuing his mission, and we're grateful to you and your colleagues for doing that as well. And is there a way, people are asking us, is there a way people can help and support the mission of We Are Not Numbers?
At this moment, We Are Not Numbers. Also, at the very beginning, we started as a voluntary program. So what we are doing is that they write for us, and then we help them to connect to international organizations, websites, and news agencies. At this moment, we decided that we're going to pay for our writers. What we do now is just pay for their pieces to help and support them financially. They are always can donate to We Are Not Numbers website if they would like to, and then their contribution will go directly to our writers in Gaza.
That's
wonderful.
Great.
And finally, just about your own work, Wala. Mm-hmm. You're far away from your family and community and neighborhood in Gaza. You're doing this incredible work with We Are Not Numbers. You've contributed to the Electronic Intifada recently. Here's your author page. Tell us about what's next for you and how you are continuing to do, you know, this honorable work of journalism and providing, a voice from the ground.
Well, this is the least thing I can do, Nora. I'm not with my family, although I wish I was there when the war has started. It feels so sad that I'm all right in a safe place while they're experiencing all this by themselves. At the same time, I feel that I can help and reflect what's going on from here and support them in terms of food and stuff more than if I was in Gaza. What I'm doing is just writing about what's going on, trying to show the world the suffering of Palestinian people, what they have to experience during this war, and that's the least I can do. I'm also part of so many initiatives in Gaza to provide some, we're currently providing some solar panels to try to repower Gaza, at least helping Palestinians in some displacement camps to repower their camps, especially during the months of Ramadan. I'm also part of many initiatives supporting food to Gaza. I'm in the middle of one right now. So this is what I can do, writing, participating in those initiatives, trying to get to support the Palestinian community, especially our writings in Gaza, writers in Gaza.
Well, Sabah, thank you so much for joining us today on the Electronic Intifada live stream. We have the website URL for We Are Not Numbers down there at the bottom of the screen, wearenotnumbers.org. Thank you so much for being with us, and we hope to have you back on really soon. Thank you so much, Wella.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Wella.
Wonderful. And you are listening to and watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm going to throw it to Asa, who's going to join us, and we're going to bring on Huda Amori.
Thanks, Nora. Today, we're welcoming back to the show Huda Amori, who's a co-founder of Palestine Action. Welcome back to the show, Huda.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for all the work you've been doing.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. We're glad you could. Palestine Action was founded, as I think most of our viewers and listeners will know, nearly four years ago now, in 2000, the summer of 2000, by activists who wanted to go beyond marches and speeches and try and actually stop the Israeli war machine in its tracks physically. And their main target has been Elbit, Israel's largest private arms manufacturer. I think Elbit had 10 factories and offices in the UK, but now only has 8. Is that right, Huda?
Yeah, so they had to shut down their Oldham site, and they left their London offices, but they have got another site now in Bristol, which they've been building for the past few years.
So the Bristol site is sort of the head office now in the UK. Is that right?
Yeah, so they have a headquarters in Bristol, Aztec West 600, and they also have a manufacturing research site, which they recently launched with the help of the Israeli embassy. But actually, interestingly, the Aztec West site in Bristol is owned by Somerset Council. So this is the only Elbit site which is actually owned by a local government, and there has been a concerted campaign against that council to evict Elbit.
And Huda, you recently wrote about how you, and just in the last few months, you and your comrades at Palestine Action have forced, I think, three companies, or is it four companies, to break their ties with Elbit Systems, which is, of course, the largest Israeli weapons manufacturer. What are those companies, and how did you force them to break their connections with Elbit?
Yeah, so the first one that cut ties was IO Associates, and they were the sole recruiters for Elbit Systems. They did all of their recruitment services for them, and they cut ties with Elbit after a two-month campaign, which involved activists storming into their offices. Actually, activists stormed into their brand new Manchester offices on the day they opened it, and they were kicked out of those offices after actions against them after about a month. And, you know, we had red paint sprayed over their different offices across the country, and it took 2 months for them to announce to us that they are cutting the contract with Elbit Systems. And we actually had someone inside IO Associates who left the company because of their work with Elbit Systems confirm that Elbit Systems was their biggest client. So that was quite significant for them to do so. After that, it was Fisher German. So that's been a 2-year campaign, and Fisher German managed the property of Elbit's factory in Shenstone. And there had been several, you know, dozens of actions against them over the past 2 years. And then they announced to us that they are cutting all ties with Elbit Systems. And then after that, we had the website designers sorry, yeah, the website designers of Elbit's Leicester factory. It took one action. Someone spray painted drop UAV on their offices, and they wrote to us immediately saying that they are no longer hosting the website for Elbit's Leicester factory and will not work with the company in the future. And then the last, but perhaps most significant, was Crane and Nagel. They are one of the world's largest shipping companies, a multi-billion pound multinational company. And they are one of only six companies who are actually licensed for the secure collection and transport of weapons and firearms. And they also wrote to us to confirm that they are cutting, they cut the contract of Elbit and to ask us to cease the campaign against them. And I think these string of victories signifies the growth of our campaign, as well as the strategy to also expand to their whole supply chain. Elbit can't operate if they don't have landlords to house them, if they don't have suppliers, they don't have recruiters. And even if they start looking for other, you know, other services by other companies, they will start reducing that. It will, the pool that they can choose from will be reduced. They'll get lower value. It's a massive distraction for them, a massive headache. And ultimately, it's just, it's mounting the pressure on Elbit Systems and their viability to continue operating.
And clearly it's working. That's really impressive. And we've spoken about in live streams in the last few weeks that at least two major Japanese companies have also cut ties with Elbit Systems. And this also followed protests and grassroots organizing in Japan. Do you talk about internationally, you know, not just Palestine Action, because we last time we had you on, you talked about Palestine Action expanding to the US and I think now to Belgium as well. Mm-hmm. And also these actions in Japan, which are not Palestine Action, but are also targeting Elbit Systems. Just give us a sense of the international picture in addition to these really incredible victories in the UK.
Yes, so we've seen the campaign against Elbit massively expand. There was an international day of action organized by Progressive International, and we saw people in Brazil taking action against Elbit over there. Like you said, also in Japan, across Europe, in America as well, in the US. And also we're seeing more actions, a lot of actions actually, in Australia, with people taking action against Elbit, occupying rooftops of weapons companies. So the international campaign is really becoming extremely strong and more of a threat to Elbit Systems globally. You know, when we were targeting Elbit Systems, we try and focus at where we are and our context and what we can do from our country. But seeing how other places, other campaign groups, other movements, Palestine Action expands as well, is becoming a global campaign against Elbit Systems. We're threatening their interests everywhere. And ultimately, that is applying a much bigger threat towards Elbit Systems and ultimately the Israeli military. And Elbit's name is being tarnished through these actions left, right, and center across the world. And I think that's a key thing as well, is within the Palestine movement, we all need to know the names of the companies who are supplying the Israeli military, who are supplying these missiles, drones, munitions to massacre the Palestinian people, because a lot of them, especially Elbit, are operating right in front of us. And it's a tangible way for us to impact the Israeli military apparatus across the world.
Yeah, I mean, it really sounds like Palestine Action, and it sounds like you've sort of expanded your victory since the last time you came on the show. I want to play a clip of the what you mentioned earlier about Somerset Council. These are the kinds of actions you've been doing, Palestine Action volunteers.
Aztec West for the last 3 years. Elbit Israel, we've seen the list, and Elbit Israel is also on the lease. It's not enough now to wash your hands and sell it. You should be terminating the lease and kicking Elbit out.
Over 26,000 Palestinians have been slaughtered, over 12,000 children killed, over 66,000 injured, and the majority of Gaza is displaced.
Thanks, Tamara. Maybe you can mute that now. So these are council sessions, right, where they're discussing the business of the local council.
Yeah, exactly. So all councils have public meetings and are open to the public. And Somerset Council, it came to light recently that they are selling off, they are planning to, I'm not sure if it's on the market yet, sell off the property of Elbit Systems headquarters at Aztec West 600, but we made it very clear that that is not adequate simply after 3 years of being complicit in the genocide and housing these war criminals. It is not good enough to simply say, well, we're going to sell it on and it won't be our problem and we won't be complicit. Actually, they now have a moral and legal responsibility to cut the lease of Elbit Systems and evict them before they sell on the property. And we know that there is a clause that says that if the tenant is doing anything immoral or illegal on the premises, then they shouldn't be in there in the first place. And I mean, what better case for an immoral and illegal company than Elbit Systems, whose CEO who said that they are crucial to the genocide, has boasted about their contracts with the Israeli military during this genocide, and is also on the board of Elbit Systems UK. And, you know, arguably by them doing this, they are making, and these are Somerset residents as well who are taking part in this campaign, who are, you know, really annoyed that they have been forced to be complicit in this genocide in such a direct way through these councillors. And, you know, one of the hypocritical statements that have come out from this council is that they want that they voted for a ceasefire in Gaza. You vote for a ceasefire while you're literally harboring the murderers of the Palestinian people. And I think we have to cut through these, you know, false statements of a show of support and actually make them, you know, actions speak a lot louder than words. And it's time for Somerset Council to kick Elbit out.
Well, I think it's brilliant whenever people can bring the issue right down to the most local level. You know, I know that one of the comebacks that the government in the UK makes is to claim that, local councils have no business making resolutions about international issues. They should be focusing on local governance. And I think what this shows is that local councils are very directly involved, whether as property owners or whether they're supplying services to companies like Elbit System that are directly engaged in genocide. So I think that's brilliant. Asa, should we talk about another action that Palestine Action did? I'll just say as background here, a few years ago, I think it was in 2010, I visited Scotland and I was very honored to be hosted for a number of events in Scotland. And one of the things my host did is they took us to visit the estate of very lovely grounds and house of someone called Lord Arthur Balfour. And I thought when I saw that lovely country estate, I sort of making a declaration that this country estate now belongs to the Palestinian people. But you recently had some of your comrades had an action related to Balfour. Can we show that video, Tamara? And that is, of course, a painting of Arthur Balfour, who, of course, made the infamous Balfour Declaration when he was the British Foreign Secretary. That was in 1917, in which he essentially gave the blessing of the British imperial government to the Zionist plan to colonize Palestine and steal it from its indigenous Palestinian people. What's happening here, Huda?
So this was an action against the Balfour painting, which is in Trinity College at University of Cambridge. And as you can see, they pretty much destroyed that painting. It's worth noting as well that Trinity College do invest in Elbit systems. But the main purpose of this action, I believe, was to highlight British complicity in the colonization of Palestine. And the fact that we are honoring figures like Balfour and, you know, having his paintings up at University of Cambridge, yet most people in this country were not aware of Balfour's role. And by default, not necessarily as aware about Britain's historic role and current role in the colonization of Palestine. So I think this action really brought out, you know, a whole debate and conversation around Balfour and around British complicity, which is good to see, because, you know, as Palestinians and obviously all of you will know about Balfour, will know about the Balfour Declaration. You know, we're raised up knowing the name of Balfour, but for British people, that's not necessarily the same. Yet he was a foreign minister in Britain when he signed away the land of Palestine without having the right to do so. So I think this has changed that. And actually people do know the name of Balfour now and understand, you know, what he did in to sign away a land which he never had any right to do. And I also think that, you know, the reaction, you know, we have actions all of the time in Palestine Action, and this one just went absolutely crazy. And I think that actually shows that the fact that it went viral in itself does show shows what society's views are in many ways, that they are shocked, so shocked about a painting that they didn't know existed being destroyed or torn apart. But yet that same reaction isn't given for when a museum is destroyed or universities are destroyed or families are massacred in Palestine. And so I think it highlights the moral inconsistencies in our society. And what do we really prioritize, figures of Balfour or our role in genocide?
And also, I think it's, you know, many people will know that Balfour was the foreign secretary in 1917, when he issued, of course, the infamous Balfour Declaration. But people might not know that Balfour was also prime minister prior to that. In fact, it's a little bit of an echo of what we have now, where David Cameron, a former prime minister, is now the UK foreign secretary. And Balfour was a precedent for that. He became foreign secretary after being prime minister. And I believe that it was in 1905 that as prime minister, he pushed for the passage of the Aliens Act, which was not just a racist law, but a specifically primarily intended at restricting Jewish immigration into the UK. And Balfour spoke up in the House of Commons in very derogatory terms about Jews in arguing for this law. So not only was Balfour an imperial racist, colonialist against Palestinians, against African people, against people in Asia, but he was very specifically and very avowedly an anti-Semite. So is it not amazing that in the UK, where there are witch hunts going on all the time, and in the Labour Party over supposed anti-Semitism, which is often not anti-Semitism, it is advocacy for Palestinian rights, that an august institution like Trinity College at the University of Cambridge would be honouring a Jew hater like Arthur Balfour.
Exactly right. And I think that, you know, doing actions like this where people can, when these points are coming through to the public, I think, you know, we are always, as you say, there's witch hunts about anti-Semitism and accusations of it, yet we don't look at our own historic figures who were so anti-Semitic that they wanted to colonize the Palestinian people in order to stop Jews from immigrating into Britain. And I think it's uncovered a lot more context to more people about the historic motivations behind the creation of the Zionist entity and the displacement of the Palestinian people. And also that, you know, Palestinians are not the ones to blame for the anti-Semitism. It's often come from European countries who have then imposed their own racism and creating another form of, you know, systematic ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people as a result. And also that this is continuing to this day. The complicity hasn't ended. It didn't end with Balfour. It began with Balfour in many ways, and it's continued to this very day. So rather than, you know, a lot of people will be sympathetic towards the Palestinian, but as people in Britain and in many different countries as well, we have to play more of an active role in fighting for the liberation of the Palestinian people, because it's not some issue that we are not connected with. Balfour and the British in many ways were the architects of allowing this to happen to the Palestinian people. And as people in this country who are opposed to that, we need to play an active role in breaking down that complicity and support for the occupation of the Palestinian people.
Yeah, I think it, the process you described, whereby there was a lot of controversy, public controversy in Britain over this particular action against this portrait of Balfour, very much reminded me of the destruction of the Edward Colston statue, the slave owner, who, you know, most people had not heard about before the statue was destroyed and dumped in the docks in Liverpool. It seems to me a very similar dynamic at play here, but maybe you could talk about, has there been any legal repercussions for the person who did this, and then maybe transition from that into talking about the recent moves to sort of smear you by the British government as extremist?
Yeah, so they haven't arrested the person who did the action, as far as I know. They did arrest someone else. They arrested someone who did an action against the Balfour statue in the House of Commons 2 years before and was found not guilty by a court. So it's clearly they did a lot of thinking there to try and arrest that person who wasn't even in the country during the time of the action. You know, great police work over there, but no one has been arrested as of yet. Who actually, you know, partakes in the action. But in terms of the, you know, the latest move, so we've seen Michael Gove, who is now trying to introduce a new definition of extremism, which they're going to announce tomorrow. And there's been a lot of leaked documents, and, you know, there's been a lot of articles mentioning that Palestine Action is supposedly going to be on this list of extremists in this country, which, you know, it's quite interesting to see how this government responds to the increased support for the Palestinian people.
What does it mean, extremist? Like, is this a like an actual prescription?
No. So apparently, according to Suella Braverman, we don't meet the bar for terrorism. So they're now trying to find a new category for extremism. But basically, as far as we understand, the most they can do is stop us from engaging with politicians and stop us from getting funding from councils and banners from speaking at universities. That is the kind of plans that they have for those who are labelled as extremists. They don't have the capacity to ban us. I mean, for us, that's not going to deter us. That's not going to stop us. And if anything, coming from a government who was so supportive and arguably is partaking in this genocide against the Palestinian people, for them to call us the extremists while they are so deeply complicit in the massacre of tens of thousands of Palestinians and the destruction of Gaza is laughable. And if we are seen as the opposite to them, then so be it. But in reality, most people in this country do not support genocide, do not consider those who are taking action to stop weapons manufacturers from partaking in genocide as the extremists, but instead those weapons manufacturers and the government are the extremists.
Well, it looks to me from what I've read about this is that, you know, if a government that that the UK thought was one of its adversaries engaged in this behavior of labeling civil society organizations, because of course it's likely not just to be Palestine Action, but perhaps a whole range of groups, including mainstream groups that support Palestinian rights or take other.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and live at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, all about performing arts in Montreal. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional student and community productions in and around Montreal. The island, also known as Jurjage in the Ganiagaha language and Muniang in Anishinaabe Moan, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end in English and in French. I'm your host, Sarah Day, live in studio on Thursday, March 14th, 2024. I am joined by the excellent Xander Chung, who will be joining us a little later this hour. And let me wish you happy Pi Day, March 14th, 2024. I love the date. I stopped by Top Pies on Park Avenue earlier today and grabbed some hand pies to go, a Ned Kelly and a buttered chicken. Hope you're celebrating Pi Day in whichever way makes sense for you, whether it's by doing some math or having some actual pie. Make it work for you. There is so much theater in the city. I'll run down some things that you can do a little later on. But coming up on tonight's show, we're going to go from wrestling and circus to puppetry to interdisciplinary to